This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Gail Lumette Buckley. She's the daughter of singer and actress Lena Horne, and her first husband was film director Sidney Lumette. This celebrity family status and racial intermarriage kept Gail isolated most of her life from blacks and from the white mainstream. It took her a long time to recognize her identity as a black or an American. Writing her new book, she says, gave her the gift of both. Gail Lumette Buckley's new book, The Hornes, An American Family, traces her family history from slavery to the move north, where they became one of the most prosperous and influential black families of Harlem and Brooklyn. They worked on behalf of civil rights and women's rights and advocated education for the advancement of blacks. The intellectual and social family traditions were broken by Lena's father, who made his money gambling and running numbers. Lena Horne became Hollywood's first glamorous black star, but between racial discrimination and blacklisting, she was given few roles. Her first husband, Gail's father, disapproved of Lena's career. Lena found a better match in her second husband, pianist and arranger Lenny Hayton, but he was white, and that introduced societal complications. Gail Buckley became intrigued by the richness and diversity of her family background when she came upon her grandfather's trunk of family artifacts. Until researching and writing this book, Gail had devoted herself fully to her work raising her family. Her children are now grown. Gail Lumette Buckley regrets that the history of the black middle class, to which her family belongs, has received so little attention.
Nobody's really cared about the black middle class because they weren't headline makers. They were people who lived, perhaps as your family might have lived, quietly going about their business. They had certain values and ethics which they firmly believed in, getting an education, rather puritanical, all the things that theoretically make for middle class life in America.
You refer to the black bourgeoisie and use that term more than the black middle class.
Yes.
Let me ask you about the choice of that expression.
Yes. Well, it comes from E. Franklin Frazier's book for the same name, The Black Bourgeoisie. And the people I'm writing about were the black bourgeoisie that he was writing about. And the black bourgeoisie was the sort of small brown mass within the great black mass within the great white world, this great segregated world, and they were sort of the buffer zone. I called them the ambassadors to either race. This was the role they saw themselves as having, and they were the people who would get the jobs when jobs were to be had, the plum jobs, I mean.
Your grandparents seem to have been in the couple that violated the traditions of the Horne family.
Third generation black sheep is what they were. They said, to heck with all this uplift and being do-gooders, because my great-grandparents were definitely do-gooders.
Meaning what?
Activists. My great-grandfather, as I said, wrote about the Civil Rights Act of 1875, founded a lobbying group called the United Colored Democracy, which was made up of disaffected black Republicans, and he was one of the reasons that the black vote, for the first black Democratic vote in New York, and the first Democratic governor in a long time in New York State, he got the black vote to switch in 1910 from the Republicans to the Democrats. My great-grandmother, on the other hand, remained Republican all her life, the party of Lincoln and Douglas, and she was a feminist, she was a suffragette, she was an early founding member of the NAACP and the National Council of Negro Women, but by the third generation, and Frazier writes about this, it was much more. The black bourgeoisie had become about cocktail parties and bridge clubs more than it was about doing good for the rest of the race. And these were the partying members of the black bourgeoisie. They were definitely the black sheeps of their respective families. And they, both of them, though they married in 1916, they really were people who were going to sort of find themselves in the 20s. And the 20s were an extraordinary time for everybody. You know, that was they were like the 60s in a way, except not politically, but socially. And to heck with old responsibilities. They both ran away from their child.
What did your grandparents do to earn the reputation of black sheep?
Well, my grandfather, theoretically, this is family history. We hope it's true, or at least I hope it's true because it's fun, made a killing on the Black Sox scandal of 1921, the baseball fix. He certainly suddenly had a lot of money in 1921 and ran off to Seattle that year, ran away from his wife and his 3-year-old daughter, Lena. And it was never to be heard of since, but to her, except through gifts and letters. And he was away out of her life for a long time. Shortly thereafter, her mother left her to go on the stage. And this was unheard of, because her mother had also been brought up in the bosom of the bourgeoisie. And the stage, the only career that a black bourgeois woman could accept honorably, was teaching. And that's when they did work, they taught, or social work. And to go on the stage was tantamount to prostitution.
So your mother ended up getting shuttled back and forth between relatives in the South and in the North.
Yes, she did. She was initially brought up by her grandmother in Brooklyn, the wonderful Cora Calhoun, feminist and suffragette. And then her mother decided, I want this child back. And she didn't really want the child. She just wanted to make her mother-in-law mad, it turns out, because she would be touring in these tent shows in the South and would leave little Lena with whoever happened to be around while she'd go off. And so my mother created a sort of dual personality for herself, her Southern personality when she'd go to one-room schoolhouses and the kids made fun of her accent and her skin color, and then the other personality that she'd have to, which was her real personality when she'd go back to her grandmother and to Brooklyn and her friends in Brooklyn.
So in a way, she was really a perpetual outsider as
yes,
a child.
Yes, she was. She was an outsider, both in the middle class in a way, even though those were her roots, and certainly with poorer blacks among whom she lived, but did not really belong.
How did your mother start in show business?
Well, she'd done amateur theatrics in clubs, in her various little clubs in Brooklyn, the Junior Debs, they were called. And they would do, she wanted to sing and dance. Her mother, she'd always had dancing and singing lessons. And she'd done amateur theatrics. And when her grandmother died, her mother decided, I'm going to put this girl on the stage. She's pretty and she's talented. Let's see what happens. So at 16, she was put into the Cotton Club.
It's interesting, your father provided protection, so
yes,
to speak, for her when she was
yes,
playing in these clubs that were frequently run by the mob.
Yes, absolutely. Dutch Schultz's mob protected her in the Cotton Club because he was very close to Dutch Schultz's black numbers men.
Well, you write that when she was 19, she had no boyfriends because her mother really wanted her to focus on the stage,
yes,
and not to be distracted.
Very strict.
What happened to her when she married young? What happened to her career?
Well, she assumed that she was going to retire. And then shortly after I was born, a call came from Hollywood, a quickie, all-black musical film was being produced in Hollywood. And some people who had seen her in the Cotton Club said, come and do this show, or this movie, without auditioning or anything. And she was not the same slim creature she'd been in the Cotton Club. She just had a baby. And she arrived, and they were sort of disappointed. But nevertheless, she made the movie, which I saw. It's kind of funny. It was called The Duke is Tops. Then when she became a star, they renamed it to Bronze Venus and made her the star. It was still the same movie. It was a sort of backstage romance, very innocuous story. And so that was sort of a dip into show business. Then she got another call after she finished that movie to be in a Blackbirds show, Blackbirds of 1939, which was a flop. But when it opened on Broadway, it only lasted about 7 performances. She got wonderful reviews from the New York Times, and all the columnists noticed her.
Did you go with her backstage to any of the shows? Were you aware of the performances she was doing when you were very young?
No, well, not at that age, not at that age. I never started going backstage till I was probably about 10. I remember seeing her in the movies when I was young, though.
What was that experience like?
Well, the first time I saw her in the movies was very scary. I saw A Cabin in the Sky, and she was in New York, and I was in California. And in the end of Cabin in the Sky, there's this big earthquake, and it looks as if she died. So I had to be taken in tears from the movie. And they had to call my mother in New York to let me know she was still in the land of the living.
Your mother spent some time touring with the Charlie Barnett Band, and they'd tour through the South.
Yes.
And run into all kinds of segregation problems. Did she ever consider trying to pass for white during that period?
She never did, though people earlier in her career and later in her career, all through her career in the early stages, people had suggested, and she always refused.
Since she was the granddaughter of people who had been very important in the black bourgeoisie in New York, did she feel that it was okay for her to be in show business or music? Did she feel like she was violating the family tradition in any way? Now, we'd spoken about how her father ended up being, your grandfather ended up being a numbers runner and gambler, and your grandmother, her mother, wanted her to be on the stage. So for her parents, show business would have been fine.
It was great. No, it was fine. But for her grandmother would have been horrified if she'd been alive. She wanted to be a teacher. She was going to be a teacher. That was all set. Even though she did encourage the music lessons, because this was all right. Bourgeois children were exposed to culture, as it were.
Was she guilty about that?
I don't think so. I think she was very interested in her career. I think she was serious about it. She had to make money. And this was the middle of the Depression when she was starting all this. And I think she had ambition. She really wanted to make it.
After some of the performances that you mentioned, like the Lou Leslie's Blackbirds of 1939, she for a while sang at Cafe Society.
Yes, that was her favorite job she ever had, so she says.
Describe what was so special about the club.
Well, it was a special place. It was very much as, I called it a seminar with drinks. Barney Josephson was an old line socialist, pacifist, who wanted to start a nightclub. It was the first integrated nightclub in New York outside of Harlem, where both the patrons and a few jazz spots would allow black customers in. But the policy was integration. The policy was no fancy, no fake palm trees, no cigarette girls. It was all it was very left wing. It was definitely very intellectually stimulating. And everybody important who was black went there, and everybody important who was white went there. So it was a fabulous meeting ground. And this is where my mother met friends of her uncles and friends of her parents. Not her parents particularly, but her grandparents, people who knew them, and especially of her uncle Frank, who were people who had become very important in her life, like Paul Robeson.
And a lot of intellectuals and writers hung out there.
Yeah.
So I guess.
And great performers. I mean, Billie Holiday, Teddy Wilson, Compton and Green.
So it's one of the places in her life where her entertaining career and her family background came together.
Came together, absolutely. Probably the only place where it really came together so neatly. And she was very happy there, and she got wonderful reviews. And it was sort of, it was where her career really began, because it was from there that she was asked to come to Hollywood to open a new nightclub. And when she did that, that was the beginning of her Hollywood career.
I thought it was interesting the way Bonnie Josephson suggested changes in her repertoire when she was singing in Cafe Society.
Yes.
Would you explain that?
Yes, and she auditioned for Barney. She first started singing Sleepy Time Down South, and he said, no, you can't sing that song. Don't you know what they do to black people in the South? So she said, oh, I'm sorry. And then she started singing a song called Down Argentina Way. He said, no, you can't sing that. There are all these girls in Brooklyn who were changing their name and pretending to be Latin. You've got to be yourself. You've got to be real. Who are you? And she said, gosh, I don't know. So Barney's a wonderful guy, maintains that he sort of taught her what to sing and how to sing it in a way.
And he suggested she just sing standards.
He said, sing standards and sing the blues, sing one blues. And she said, I can't sing the blues. She'd never sang the blues. The black bourgeoisie did not approve of the blues. And he said, nonsense, sing Billy's Blues, which is Billie Holiday's song. And she just was so nervous about it and felt she couldn't do it. So she went to talk to Billie Holiday, who said, do you have two children to take care of? Do you, so you can just sing it and don't worry about anything else. She was a wonderful woman, sad, wonderful woman.
Did you meet her?
I never met her. At least I don't think so. Maybe I did when I was a tiny child, but I don't remember. But she was very good to my mother.
My guest is Gail Lumet Buckley, and she's written a new book called The Horns, an American Family, which is a history of her family. When your mother, Lena Horne, signed her MGM contract, she was, as you describe her, the first glamorous black star in Hollywood. So, I mean, before her, what could
What could
Blacks
do in Hollywood?
Well, you played domestics or you played jungle extras. She was also the first long-term contract ever given a Black player in Hollywood. And she was Walter White and Paul Robeson's test case. She was a test case to the NAACP, which had decided they were going to change the image of Hollywood. It was World War II. Okay, let's, you know, we're supposed to be fighting for democracy. Let's do it at home. And this was part of this program. And she was it. She was the test case. And that made her the enemy of a lot of Black actors in Hollywood who were very upset. And they said, you're trying to take work away from us. There'll be no more jungle movies. There'll be no more old plantation movies. What are you trying to do? And Paul Robeson said to her, these people aren't important. The people who matter are out there, the Pullman porters, those people. And they want to see a new image. And you've got to do it. She said, okay.
So what did Paul Robeson want your mother to do?
Wanted her to refuse to play a domestic, to refuse to play any role that was demeaning to the to Blacks, and to stick by that and not be swayed from it.
Did she have any doubts about taking on this?
Well, she did. She did. And she went back to New York and kind of very upset. I mean, it had all been so fast.
It's quite a responsibility.
It's an incredible responsibility. And she'd been this sort of overnight huge success in the Hollywood nightclub. She'd auditioned for Louis B. Mayer, who'd said, yes, sign her up instantly. And, of course, the first role that they screen tested her for was for a maid part. So they were really kind of trying to get out of it. They weren't taking it very seriously. But Robeson and Walter White were taking it seriously, and she was taking it seriously. And her father, Teddy Horn the gambler, came out to Hollywood, flew out very dapper, and demanded an interview very politely with Louis B. Mayer and said, I can afford to hire a maid for my daughter. She doesn't need to play a maid. And they were bowled over by this. They'd never seen anything like Teddy Horn or heard anything like that from a Black man who was not political anyway.
Did they know about his affiliation
they
with gangsters?
They knew nothing about him except that he was incredible. He wore handmade shoes and sulca ties, and he walked in and spoke very coolly and quietly and said he wasn't going to let his daughter do anything that was undignified. So they had this, the family coming at them from one end, and Paul Robeson and Walter White of the NAACP from the other end, and they were stuck with doing the right thing.
So did she get roles? Were there roles for her?
There were no roles. There were never roles. And my mother always just had was sort of in a part because all her part scenes were cut out of the South. In the South, her scenes were cut out. So she had to be filmed separately. So she never had roles. She just had moments in movies.
Why don't you explain how that worked when they cut out parts that she was in,
yes,
in the South, like in Words and Music, which
yes,
was
they would cut
the
out
the movie biography of Rodgers and
yes,
Hart.
Yes, they would cut out The Lady is a Tramp, which she sang in it. They would just snip it out, take scissors and snip, snip, when it got south the Mason-Dixon line.
So she couldn't be in anything that furthered the plot.
No, she could never be in anything that furthered the plot or was crucial to, it was a crucial moment in the movie, never.
She must have been very frustrated.
She must have been.
Did she ever talk to you about that?
She only talked about it when she did her show, funnily enough. Finally. She compensated by making a very hugely successful nightclub career and a very successful career in Europe. And that was what she did.
Did MGM want to keep your mother under contract since they weren't giving her...
Well,
kind of
yeah,
roles
you know
that
why they did.
For.
Yeah, they did because she was very key to the Lowe's vaudeville key chains. They owned a lot of theaters, and she would play those theaters, the Capitol in New York. Whatever they were, they don't exist anymore. So she was good for their image. We're not racist. We have Lena Horne. She was there. So they could never be accused of racism.
She really got it from all sides.
She did. She did. But I think the forerunners always do. Look at Paul. Look at Jackie Robinson.
Why did she leave Hollywood? Did the contract run out?
I think she just sort of got fed up and wanted to get away. And also, she wanted to get married, and they couldn't marry in Hollywood. It was illegal for blacks and whites to marry in 1946. And she had a big fight with MGM in 1946 because they wanted her to be in a musical called St. Louis Woman, which had a wonderful score by Harold Arlen. And she sort of really wanted to do it, and MGM was backing it. But once again, she listened to the NAACP and Walter White, who said, don't do it, it's a demeaning role, which I think in this case was a mistake.
Why?
Well, because it was a great score. It was, so she would have played a prostitute. I mean, you know, so what? It was on the stage. And it was, you know, it was, I think it would have been a great career opportunity for her to have been earlier on Broadway than she was.
Did she feel as strongly about the politics of the roles as the people who were advising her did?
I think she felt so strongly about, I think her respect for them was probably as great as her feelings. I think she was very torn in the St. Louis Woman incident. But I think she probably, she was very politicized, and Paul was very much a mentor, and Walter White. So I think she probably felt nearly as strongly.
When your mother married Lenny Hayton, he white, she black, it was illegal.
Yes.
At the time. Did they explain that to you?
They didn't say it was illegal. They said they were getting married and it was a secret. That was all they said to me.
Would they tell you why you couldn't tell anybody?
No, they just said, don't tell anybody. And then, like, I was about 10 years old, so by 3 years later, when it was no longer a secret, I totally understood why.
Did that mean that you were moving more into the white world once that marriage
happened? Yes, it did. We were out of the black world. We were out of the ordinary white world. We were into that world, and it was white. It was the international celebrity world.
Your family spent a lot of time in Europe.
Yeah.
Was that for political and racial
reasons?
Yeah,
it was because, yes, it was to avoid the blacklisting. And my mother was blacklisted from TV for a while. And so we were in Europe most of the 50s. I mean, every summer we'd be in Europe.
During this period, she became very popular in nightclubs.
Yeah.
But you say that she really hated nightclubs.
Hated nightclubs.
Why?
Well, because usually they were run by the mob. And she considered most of them, her bosses, to be very unsavory characters. She hated the audiences in Las Vegas. She hated everything about Las Vegas, but she made a lot of money. And in those days, Las Vegas was slightly, if you could call it, more elegant than it is now. I mean, it was really a mecca for huge stars. And there were only a few hotels. And you didn't get little old ladies getting off of buses. You got more sort of serious gambling people. And the money was enormous. It probably still is enormous. But probably much more so. But it was the place. It was, I mean, that's what you did. And she did hate it. She always said, I hate show business.
She was doing some TV then, too.
Yeah, she was doing a bit, but not a lot. No blacks had their own show when she wanted to have her shows.
Were there things that she couldn't do when performing with white people on TV?
You weren't meant to touch a white performer. A white performer wasn't meant to touch a black performer on television in the 50s. And Perry Como... there were certain people who Perry Como always took her arm or always put his arm around her. There were certain people who consciously flaunted the unwritten rule of no blacks and whites touching on television.
You went to Harvard, and your going to Harvard coincided with the Civil Rights Movement.
No, it didn't, actually.
I
graduated in 1959.
Oh, I thought you went a little later than
no,
that.
No, I graduated before there was the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, the pill, pot. We were prehistoric. We were the Eisenhower generation. When I was a senior, my roommate's fiance said, let's go picket Woolworths. This was 1959. And I said, why are we picketing Woolworths? I mean, I knew they were picketing Woolworths in the South, but I didn't connect the Cambridge, Massachusetts Woolworth with the Southern Woolworth. I was really naive and silly. But there was no civil rights. There was nothing going on. That's why I went to you. I thought I was going to stay in Europe and live there.
When the Civil Rights Movement...
Well, it was Kennedy that got me back.
Mm-hmm.
In 1960, I came home and immediately went out and campaigned for Kennedy and made speeches for him and voted for him, the first person I voted for. My entire class, the entire Harvard class, or the people I knew, I won't say the entire, but I mean a huge percentage, went to Washington. They were, and so half of them went to the Justice Department, half of them went to the Peace Corps. I was going to go and work for the USIA, and then I got married instead. I was at Life, and I went down and was investigated by the FBI and everything. But I met Sidney and decided not to take that job.
Now, you write in your book that your mother did not want you to marry because he was a lot older than you.
He was a lot older, and he had three wives, or I would have been his third wife.
How serious a split was that between you and your mother over this marriage?
Not serious enough for her not to come to the wedding and be the mother of the bride and all that, which was not, it was a terrible wedding because it was the day after Kennedy was shot. So it was a nightmare of a wedding.
What kind of racial sense did your children grow up with?
My children are very funny because their strongest racial identity is Jewish, which is their father. And their father is not a religious Jew at all. He's culturally a Jewish person. So it's not even religious. Though I must say, after they read the book, they both sort of jokingly said, oh, if we'd known we were American Indian, we might have been more interested in that, you know, aspect of their lives.
What did the book do for your mother, do you think?
She's very happy with it. She's very proud of me. And she discovered new things about her family. And I think she feels very happy. She feels, she feels that it's given her a kind of sense of roots, too, that she sort of knew vaguely a lot of this. But now it's a good feeling.
It places her in a social and historical context
Yes.
that she might felt.
No, exactly. No, she didn't feel it, especially having had this really sad childhood, being torn between her two sets of relations and feeling like an orphan. And this has given her a sense of belonging.
Gail Lumet Buckley has been my guest. Her new book, The Horns, An American Family, is published by Knopf. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineer was Audrey Voblaitis. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks a lot for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview, or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4802. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.